Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the battlegrounds in that war, which has for far too long been neglected largely, is Africa, an immense continent with hundreds and hundreds of millions of people. One of its most important countries is Nigeria. It is situated in West Africa on the coast. It has substantial oil and gas reserves and other natural resources. And it is a country in grave turmoil at the moment. Indeed, some warn, like Congressman Frank Wolf, former member of the United States House of Representatives, of an imminent implosion in that country, with potentially incalculably awful repercussions for its people, for those of the region, for the continent of Africa, and far beyond. I had the privilege on Thursday of participating in a program that featured Nigeria. It was sponsored in part by a new organization of which I am the president and CEO, the Save the Persecuted Christians, it's called. And we were privileged to be able to convene in the company of some prominent Nigerians, a second program after a rollout of ours. And you can see this at SaveThePersecutedChristians.org if you're interested in going to the video of the launch event at the National Press Club. But we also were privileged to share the stage in the second part of the program with individuals of the Nigerian American diaspora and others from Nigeria who were there to bear witness to what is happening to Christians, yes, but also to many others, including to the country of Nigeria itself, at the hands of, well, Sharia supremacists, I think is the short form of it. One of the men who presented in the course of that very impressive program was Tony Nnadi. He is a barrister, that is to say an attorney by training. He is also the Secretary General of the Lower Niger Congress. And the Lower Niger Congress, as we'll be discussing with him, is an organization that has been convened to try to help both the people of Nigeria in-country and their expatriate community in this and in other parts of North America to help preserve and hopefully save the Nigeria that has been in distress for quite some time, as Tony Nnadi will describe for us now. Tony is an articulate and impressive advocate for freedom and for those who are at risk of losing it, both in his native land and far beyond, if the Sharia supremacists have their way. I'm very pleased to say he's agreed to be with us for a full hour to discuss this extraordinarily important topic, and I look forward to doing so with him. Tony Nnadi, welcome very, very sincerely to Secure Freedom Radio. It is a delight to have you with us, and I appreciate you giving so generously of your time to discuss this important matter.
Thank you, Frank, for having me, and I welcome the audience to this important session.
Well, good. Let me start by helping those of us who may not be able to find Nigeria on the map, perhaps, or certainly understand its importance to the continent of Africa and the world, to do some level setting with you. Can you help us with first the geography of Nigeria? Where is it and what's around it?
Yes, Nigeria is in the region of Africa where you have to the Atlantic waterfront, you call the Gulf of Guinea, and then on the upper side, the Lake Chad Basin. Nigeria is sandwiched between that Gulf of Guinea. In fact, it's very much a part of the Gulf of Guinea and the Lake Chad Basin. You have Cameroon to the eastern side. You have the West Africa, the rest of West Africa, Nigeria is part of that West Africa, which includes Ghana and the rest of them. And then to the north of it is these ungoverned spaces that begins with the Libya of recent dislocation. And you have Sudan in that northern flank. You have the Sudan that boiled over only recently, hasn't quite settled. And you have Chad, you have Niger, where soldiers, American soldiers were killed not long ago. And these are the places that surround Nigeria. To the northwest, you have the northern Mali, the parts that the Islamist Varangere and before the French intervention. So Nigeria is sitting in the middle of this, places mentioned.
And if I could just interrupt you, one of the things that has characterized, I think, virtually all of the countries you've just mentioned, to say nothing of some like the Central African Republic and the Democratic Republic of Congo, which are not too far away either, they're all in turmoil or in grave danger of, coming undone as they've existed at least to this point. Which has considerable bearing on the point I think you're getting to, which is that this is a part of the world that we better be paying much closer attention to.
Yes, because of the sheer number of people that are trapped in the enclave, and we're talking about 200 million people, which also will immediately affect the immediate sub-region, the rest of West Africa. We have about 15 countries that depend entirely on what happens in Nigeria. So you could have another 50 to 60 million people to worry about. If anything goes wrong with Nigeria, in less than 48 hours, the global community will be worrying about what to do with no less than 250 million refugees. I mean, people who will be running helter-skelter, in all directions. The only other thing to mention is that in that Nigeria, those who may have heard about Biafra before, because these are the same issues that led to the war the whole world had to help manage in 1967 to 1970, where the peoples of the eastern half of southern Nigeria, the ones that declared themselves the Republic of Biafra, when these Islamic forces came in genocide against them, they fought for 3 years and more than 3.5 million of them got killed. The issues that led to that fight, the forces, the very persons, human beings who led that fight, trying to eliminate the populations in the place to take over their assets, because incidentally the oil and gas assets that come from that Nigeria, because that's about the only thing the global community knows about Nigeria, that it sells oil along with a few other countries. That entire stock of that oil is in that eastern part, and these Islamic forces had come to wipe off the population to become the new owners of the asset. Of course, they've now expanded their gaze.
We have to take a short break. We will be right back to discuss more with the Secretary General of the Lower Niger Congress, Tony Nnadi, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're spending this hour on the distant shores of Africa, at least virtually, with an extraordinarily knowledgeable and articulate tour guide. His name is Tony Nnadi. As I mentioned earlier, I had the privilege of being with him when he addressed a program that was sponsored, an impressive program at that, sponsored by Nigerian expats led by Dr. Shayo Ajibuwe and Stephen Anada. We'll be talking more about that program in the course of this hour with Tony Nnadi. But Tony is with the Lower Niger Congress, which has an arm here in the United States to help spread the word and stay in touch with the very large Nigerian-American expatriate community. And Tony, you were just helping us sort of situate on the map in a zone of great and growing turmoil, unfortunately, a country of 200 million people. Tell us a bit more about the makeup of that Nigerian population, both in terms of tribes and in terms of religious denominations, persuasions.
Yes, for the global audience, it will suffice to think of Nigeria in three blocks. There is definitely the South, which is basically Christian, and the Republican in nature, not in worldview, not feudalist. And there is the far north, the part that has embraced Sharia and feudalism, and which has been on a mission of taking the entire country for itself, just like we've seen elsewhere. And that part has 12 states out of Nigeria's 36 states. Those 12 contiguous states imposed simultaneously Sharia in year 2000 and began to dislodge people and whole communities in the next adjoining territory, which is the Middle Belt. So you have to the south, you have the block to the south and the block to the Middle Belt that has a Benue, Plateau, Nasarawa, Adamawa, all of these places you hear about killings in recent time. They are Christians, but they were part of the northern Nigeria that was governed for almost 80 years by these Muslim far north that now has 12 states. And where we are now is that they've gone beyond just proclaiming Sharia for themselves, contrary to the provisions of the constitution that brings Nigeria together, that Nigeria is a secular union between all these blocks. And it was carefully decided to be so. And even at the time independence was being negotiated, that part that has gone back to Sharia now wanted Sharia. But the British had to set up a commission that settled some of those questions. And they removed, the compromise was that Sharia was removed from the table and they brought in what they call the penal code, so that the Middle Belt that was part of that northern region of the time could be in that region being Christians and not be molested. It was a fundamental part of the discussion of how that Middle Belt could be part of that north. And by extension, how Nigeria could be one country. Because if the Middle Belt that is sharing the Hausa lingua franca with the rest of the Sharia Belt of to the upper north, could be so indisposed, could be so, reluctant to become a part of a region that will be governed together with them included, you can then imagine the South that had nothing in common, not religion, not language, not culture, not even any serious commerce. And so it became a fundamental thing that Sharia should not be brought near the Union.
Yeah. Let me just take a moment, because I think our audience is pretty familiar with this term, but just to help again characterize what the problem is, Sharia, of course, is an Islamic doctrine that is described as the path or Sharia law by some. It is truly a comprehensive way of living that all faithful Muslims are supposed to conform to, and it is characterized by a really brutal supremacist, misogynistic, and otherwise freedom debilitating kind of code that, if imposed on others, typically is to their great detriment. either it will result in their extermination if they don't convert, or at the very least their sort of reduction to a sort of dhimmi status, as it's called, a second or third class slave citizenry. So when you're talking, Tony Nadi, about the northern belt populated by people who do practice Islam according to Sharia, and by definition thereby are ordered to try to expand its reach through jihad, this inevitably was going to make it tricky for people in the Middle Belt or the South if there was not some check on the expansionist tendencies of the people in the North. And what has, of course, happened since that constitution was adopted, I guess with the encouragement of the Brits, has been the rise of what some call Islamist tendencies or simply Sharia supremacist forces elsewhere, as well as in Nigeria. So talk first about those forces in Nigeria, and then we'll get to some points that you were making last Thursday about the Islamic State and others who are now finding that to be a fertile ground for their supremacist program.
Yes. The thing that has made the Nigerian case a lot more volatile is also the feudalist angle to the Fulani, who are the main, the Fulani, is that a supremacist group that has overrun that place and established control. There are people they met there who they basically subjugated to a point of no voice anymore.
Now, again, the Fulani are Islamic tribesmen, as I understand it. They're nomads, but they've become increasingly armed and aggressive towards the non-Muslim population. Is that right?
Yes. The ethnic drivers of this Sharia movement are the Fulani, who themselves are feudalists in their worldview. Quite apart from Sharia, they do not believe that all men are born equal. In their world, there's only the master and the slave. And things like democracy is offensive to them. They don't want to discuss. They don't believe that the slave should be competing for space with his master. And the slave is not entitled to anything, including the right to life or property. And therefore, they see the rest of Nigeria as that slave. On one side, being feudalists, the rest of us are slaves in their eyes. On the other side, being Shariaists, the rest of us are infidels in their eyes. So either way, we are already condemned. The rest of Nigeria is already condemned to death, because if you insist on democracy and constitutionalism, you are offending them, because it should be a matter of a master and servant that should never be put in competition. If you then say you are Christian or you want something else, you are an infidel. And in their Sharia, they are entitled to, they owe it a standing duty of faith to kill the infidel. And as feudalists, they owe it a standing political duty to themselves to prevent their slaves from bolting away. Because in the subjugation that they have been helped to achieve by the colonial Britain that came working with them, and we have to come back to that point of what they came from outside. That Fulani is an itinerant population. They don't have any country to which they domicile. They are a nomadic population.
Yeah, throughout much of this Lake Trad region, as I understand it. But let me turn, before we run through too much of this block, I just want to introduce another force in all of this, about which we've heard much more in the West than we have of the Fulanis, and that is Boko Haram. How do they fit into this picture, Tony Nadi?
Boko Haram was simply a creation, a deliberate creation of that caliphate, the Fulani-led caliphate, to overrun, to seize power in Nigeria. And they used it maximally. Unfortunately, there were some elements in the West that worked with them somehow, because at the time that Boko Haram should have been contained for what it is, should have been categorized for what it is, somehow it was delayed in the days of Hillary as Secretary of State, and all the way to when Obama left office, it was like a rigmarole. And then they managed to use that Boko Haram to cause so much of havoc, and they shot their way to power. You will recall what led to the outcome of the elections of 2015, in which a Southern Christian president was hounded out of office. Combination of all kinds of falsehoods and propaganda, and a lot of bloodshed, because it was a matter of, oh, if only one of us could come, this thing could be contained. They were making it increasing the volume of blood that had to be shed to maintain that pretense that it was the weakness of the man from the other side. Bottom line, they used Boko Haram to push their way to power.
Tony, let me ask you to just suspend for a second, because I'm out of time for this block. So we will be right back to discuss more with the Secretary General of the Lower Niger Congress, Tony Nnadi, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are visiting with Tony Nnadi, an attorney, a barrister, as they call him, in Nigeria, a man who has been devoting much of his life to trying to perpetuate the rights and freedoms of people in his country, and has done so as the Secretary General of the Lower Niger Congress. I had the privilege of meeting Tony and hearing from him at a splendid event sponsored by Mission Africa International and the International Committee on Nigeria, in conjunction with a program that the Save the Persecuted Christians organization, which I'm the president, sponsored last week in the National Press Club. And Tony, I was so impressed by what you said, and I encourage people to take a look at that. Well, frankly, both blocks of this program at YouTube, but specifically, you have laid out a concern not just about the so-called militants, the Fulanis, Boko Haram, the Islamic State, for that matter, that has been adopted as the sponsors of the Boko Haram, but about the government of Nigeria itself. And you were sort of walking through a little bit of the departure from office of Goodluck Jonathan, the Christian president under a cloud of corruption and other charges. But he was replaced by a Muslim who has proven to be, it sounds like, rather more accommodating to these Sharia supremacists than he had led on would be the case when he was running for office. Talk about what's happened under his government in connection with the sort of travails that you've described of people being forced from their home, the cleansing of regions of Nigeria, and more.
Yes. There are things in the public domain which people can easily remember or research or reference. We recall that in the period about 2014, ahead of the election of 2015 in Nigeria, at the peak of the activities of Boko Haram, that they had exchanged flags and pledged loyalty to the ISIS of the time. It became something that they say, yes, we are here as an arm of ISIS.
Part of the larger caliphate that ISIS had established.
Yes. And now in the midst of that, the candidate that was of the opposition that was trying to get to power, Muhammad Buhari. You remember there was a time the government of Jonathan was pressured into some kind of discussion that they said you must set up a discussion with this group so that some solution could be found. That Boko Haram had nominated Muhammad Buhari, the one that's president of Nigeria now, as the chief negotiator, the one who will represent them at meetings being set up in Saudi Arabia at the time. And he is also, he had said in public in that period that an attack on Boko Haram was an attack on the North. He was basically their spokesman, their political, their chief political protector to say, you know, you couldn't miss the point that Islam was what he had pledged to pursue all his life. I'm talking about Muhammad Buhari now. These are things in the public domain. He had said it at the time Sharia was introduced in the year 2000, that God willing, he will, anything that is within his reach, at that time he wasn't president, that anything that was within his reach, he will use to spread Islam throughout Nigeria. That's on the side of Islam. Then on the side of the killings, what has now become mixed up as a power, you know, that is being deployed for seizing the sovereign space as a minority group that is now in control of all the guns and all the treasury. You know, he is also the grand patron of the Cattle Breeders Association. You hear about Fulani herdsmen, because that's what the Boko Haram first transformed into. They pretended they were herdsmen. They would come with cows, and then in the name of grazing, they begin to set up a fight, and then communities are dislodged, and you could see the active connivance of with people in government. And elections had come and gone, and their man had become president. So you couldn't draw the line between what was happening illicitly and what was happening, what government was doing about it. And when you look at some of the public responses of that government of the current government of Muhammad Buhari, to the cries of those who are being killed in the Middle Belt, the governor would go to say, "Oh, we're being killed by strangers," and he says, "Oh, go home and learn how to live with them." That is the president, that's commander in chief, in a constitutional arrangement in which only the federal government had, exclusive control of all the guns in the land, police, army, you know. Where will you get the gun to go and defend yourself from people who come from mostly across the border outside Nigeria to come to dislodge your communities under your watch as governor? The Inspector General of Police did actually say in public too that they showed that those who had put in place laws to impede the movement of the herdsmen, you know, anti-grazing law they call them, that those laws should be removed for them to have their peace. This is the police that's supposed to be going to their aid, people being killed. Then we had the army chief, the chief of army staff, saying that there were grazing routes for those cattle long before Nigeria came, and that if people have chosen to put developments on where should have been grazing cattle grazing routes, that they should be ready to contend with whatever they see. These are all the, so between the, of course, the spokesman of the president once went saying that people should learn how to prefer their lives to their land. That is, give up your land and keep your life. Between what the president has said and done, and his service chiefs in all the arms, and this spokesman, you could see that they were on the side of this invading force, to all intents and purposes.
This is very helpful. Let me just see if I can distill it down so that I've got it, and hopefully my audience has. There was a fellow by the name of Muhammadu Buhari who was elected as an alternative to the Christian former president, promising sort of to behave in a benign way, as I understand it. In practice, however, he has, both in his own right and through his subordinates, been accommodating to, if not actually supportive of, these Fulani tribesmen, herdsmen, militants, whatever you want to call them, who are basically militia, Boko Haram under a different, flag, but basically promoting Sharia's expansion at the expense of Christian populations in lands they've long resided in. And that the effect is to drive those Christians from their lands and create conditions under which more violence is almost certainly going to occur. And I just wanted to ask you one question. This is what's happening is often described, as you know, Tony Nnadi, as a cycle of violence or a clash between these Christians and these Sharia supremacists. Is that accurate?
No, that's a dubious narrative consciously set up to deceive. There's no clash anywhere. The indigenous peoples, the owners of those territories, are in their communities. the Constitution forbids them and their state governments from touching arms that is not in the hands of federal government, then these strangers come to meet them in those communities to kill them and dislodge whole populations. And then somebody turns around to say it is a clash between who and who. These are insiders. And we recall the General Danjuma, Theophilus Danjuma, the former chief of army staff, who had to raise an alarm that what was going on was ethnic cleansing by these Fulani elements, and that the government and the government forces, that the army and the police that were supposed to be protecting citizens, were hands in glove with them, were in collusion with them. It was a loud alarm he raised. And for a man who was a chief of army staff of Nigeria, who had been involved in this matter since 1966, he certainly knew what he was saying, because his own community had come under attack. And he was in a position to know that those invaders were receiving help from the government forces that were supposed to be protecting the people.
Let me just ask you for a point of clarification, Tony. You mentioned the term ethnic cleansing, which is familiar from lots of other places in the world, notably the former Yugoslavia and the Middle East and so on. It sounds as though it's not so much ethnic cleansing as it is religious cleansing. Is that not a more accurate way to describe it? Is it that it's a tribe that is being cleansed, or is it really that if you're not Muslim, you are subject to being removed forcibly from the land or simply killed?
That was why I introduced earlier the phenomenon of the Fulani, that's the ethnic content of this mix. Yes, the Sharia was there, but the same people promoting this Sharia are also ethnic supremacists. They are Fulani. And in that alchemy, you have a terrible mix in which they come at you waving the religious flag. But when the chips are down, even those who are Muslims but not of their own stock in those places, they are overrunning. They kill them along. So it boils down. They play the cards. They have some intricate balancing they do to maintain certain pretenses. They need to maintain them. But bottom line is that when we say a caliphate, it is the religion is the toga they have to wear to be able to put a pretense around the real. It's an invasion to exterminate those who own the place, because they came from outside Nigeria. They came by jihad in 1804. And their eyes are on the entire territory. And they've used everything they could find to, now the Islamic, the global Islamic caliphate movement has taken advantage of the situation they've created in the place.
We have to wrap up for just a moment. Tony Nnadi, we will be coming back to sort of the geostrategic implications of what you've just described is taking place at the moment in Nigeria right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are finishing up a full hour of very, very unsettling and disturbing conversation with a man who has been warning about and seeking help with the crisis now unfolding in his native land of Nigeria. His name is Tony Nnadi. He is the Secretary General of the Lower Niger Congress, a group that is dedicated to trying to help the indigenous peoples of Nigeria resist the predations of what is now being done in the name of Sharia supremacism or the efforts to seek control over the entire country by Fulani militia. And Tony, you were just at the end of the last block setting up what the stakes are here. Talk a little bit further about what ISIS is up to, as well as sort of the larger enterprise of establishing a caliphate in Africa that would benefit mightily, needless to say, from control of Nigeria and the oil and gas resources, among others, that it controls.
Yes, the danger, in fact, the reason I came to town, you will recall that there's a congressional hearing already set up on Nigeria. I'm listed to address that hearing, and if not for the shutdown, it probably will have been on the way by now. But as that awaits, we had to do the program we did to call attention to the matter as it's developing. What has happened now is that the conditions created by Boko Haram and the so-called herdsmen, there are no herdsmen, they're just Fulani militia, have quickly grown into something the global Islamic movement has taken advantage of. And remember, I mentioned that Boko Haram, at the peak of their glory, had exchanged flags with ISIS. And from that point on, most of the big attacks were now happening in the name of ISIS itself. And we recall that a few weeks ago, the joint operational headquarters of the multinational task force that was supposed to be fighting them in the north, in the northeast there, including the armies of Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger, was sacked by an ISIS West African operation unit, with a lot of armored battle tanks and all kinds of things. So they dislodged them. They chased away the military from the place and have been in occupation of the place, as well as nearby bases all around. Where that has led is that Islamic caliph that is being challenged in the Middle East has managed to establish a passage, a route that cross between the eastern flank of the Africa adjoining that Middle East, so much of ungoverned territory, Central African Republic, to the south, and then Sudan and all of that, with everything Libya had introduced in that axis. They have established some connection with that hot, the boiling space of the northeast of Nigeria. And the way they're going with the support we can all see from afar, they're getting from the Nigerian state itself, the current organizers of the Nigerian state, the current government in place. We fear that if they get to the next election, they are pushing everybody to election at a time these issues should have been resolved first, because the constitution is disputed. They want to get under 4 years by all means. Of course, we all hear about all the things they've already done in an attempt to win the election by all means, chasing opposition people all around. If they get those 4 years, we suspect that it is for them to roll their tanks deeper into, southwards from where they've arrived. Now, they are done with the upper the north. They are in the middle belt doing havoc, and they will roll into the south. And when they do that, it might come to where they seize the sovereign space, the entire sovereign space of Nigeria. And we already know Chad and Niger and northern Mali, each of which is bigger than Nigeria. We already know that those places are basically ungoverned spaces. They're like satellite playstations for Nigeria all this while. But with this monster coming in no time, if they overrun the sovereign space of Nigeria, these other territories will come back to be like Nigeria times five, being in the control of Islamic movement, and the oil resources and all the other things that they can get here will become, a functional base for them to relaunch their global campaign, which they have been stopped in the Middle East, substantially from doing. They've relocated here, and the reason we have now come to the United States to inform everybody that, when instead of allowing the whole thing to come to where 250 million people are running helter-skelter because everybody's going to feel something about it, boots will have to be put on ground down the road, the United States can help at this time to stop the matter from getting that bad by appointing a special envoy that will come to, sit down with all of those who are contending in one part or the other to put the kind of solution that can contain this. What the U.S. Been doing in the region is based on a misdiagnosis. Of course, I'm sure many saw the report of the U.S. Army War College in Pennsylvania 2013 titled Nigerian Unity in the Balance. People can Google it, where the military had taken their time to look at what was going on in the region and advised Washington, to do the things along the lines of what we are proposing now. that a line has to be drawn to prevent this monster from seizing that sovereign space. Because if that is not done, it becomes a much bigger problem that will consume a lot more, you know, destabilize everything, you know, you could think about, and becomes a lot more costly for all the sides.
Okay, so let's just recap then, because this is really the crux of the problem. Yeah. You have a Nigeria that is at risk of falling to Sharia supremacists who will set in train, if that were to occur, not only the acquisition of immense resources in the form of Nigeria's oil and gas wealth, but also driving populations, both from Nigeria itself and other parts of the region, into not only Africa and, you know, the wide reaches of that continent, but presumably into places like Europe as well, quite possibly making what we've seen there and all of the destabilization and trauma that it's created from the refugee flows from the Middle East primarily and elsewhere pale by comparison. So this is a global problem of the first order. And what you're saying, Tony Nnadi, as I understand it, and I very much agree with it, by the way, is that were the United States to engage at this point, and it seems like a relatively modest thing to ask, but simply to have a special envoy established by the president for the purpose of helping forge American government-wide policy, but also to engage the government and the other participants in this drama in Nigeria to try to stave off this imminent train wreck. Does that basically capture the idea?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What resistance is there, as you see it now, to this modest request? I mean, it seems to me to be the least we can do. We've got special envoys for all kinds of things, including one that was just named, as I recall, for Syria, I think it was. But what is it that impedes this request from being honored?
I would think that the people who are, you know, committing the atrocities are also maybe they have their lobby, they have their narratives, their falsehood they've set up. They have a lot of money to service their lobby that goes to tell, you know, the wrong story to those who are not probed. But we have come now to tell as people from the battlefield there, you know, those who have a stake, including especially the U.S., you know, because no matter what anybody does, if the matter is allowed to degenerate beyond what it is, and it becomes a global, you know, catastrophe of the type we can already see. The U.S. already has its hands full with what we see, the matter with Southern Latin America and the border war with Mexico. People are going to be under pressure to get here. And is it not better for that, for the problem to be resolved where it is? So that because we have ground operations, we have networks, we have a new consensus, a new majority that is capable of reworking the entire thing. This minority that is causing havoc is like cancer, and what we have in our hand is the best quarantine plan that can be, you know, used to contain that cancer before it spreads and becomes unmanageable.
Tony Nnadi, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but thank you so much for your time today, as well as for the work you're doing at the Lower Niger Congress. I hope that you will come back to us with updates soon. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.